Good morning, welcome to our meeting, 9 a.m. June 17th, 2025, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Julieta Alterano Crosby, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Legal Officer, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, Jeanette Sutton, Senior Business Operations Coordinator, and Daniel Tover, paralegals. Thank you both for helping us today.
Yeah.
Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices at this time. So I will begin with the flag salute. You may join me if you wish. Pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's table under the entrance. Commissioners, are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda? Comments from the public is item one on today's agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes. The person will be recognized to speak from sign-up cards located on the deputy clerk table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, please click raise hand or dial *9 if by phone. I will call on attendees to speak at the appropriate time. When you are called upon on a phone, dial *6 on mute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state, spell your name, and indicate where you are from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents for the materials entered for the record, please hand them to the deputy clerk, who will distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues will be brought to the floor for discussion. So first on our agenda is comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not on today's agenda? I'm not seeing any hands raised in the room. I'm not seeing any hand raised online. Item two is our consent agenda. 2A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of June 3rd, 2025. 2B, bid awards, professional service contracts and amendments. And 2C, consideration of certification slash ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? Please raise your hand. Maybe your hands up online or in the room. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments about the consent agenda?
I don't have any. I have none today.
I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carried unanimously. Next, item three, our CEO General Manager Briefing and Study Session. This item is for the board and our CEO to discuss issues among ourselves with PUD staff. John Harlow will facilitate the discussion. Good morning, John.
Hey, good morning, Commissioners. So we've got a number of great presentations this morning, so we'll get right at it. First one is the continuation of the 2025 financing, and that will be Lauren Way. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning, Commissioners. Good morning, John. I'm Lauren Way, Manager of Treasury and Financial Risks. I'm here today to talk about our 2025 financing, so giving an update from our prior presentation on June 3rd. Okay, so again, providing an update, we're going to go through a quick update in the market compared to when we last spoke on June 3rd, and then we'll walk through the new money structure. So back on June 3rd, we talked a lot about concepts around the issuance. Today, we're going to be looking at a lot of numbers and graphs. So we'll go through the new money structure, the combined electric and generation 2010 and 2015 refunding and the impacts that those have on our debt, on our existing debt service structure, and then take a peek at the aggregate future debt service expectations. So for today, no action of the board, but we will be back on June 1st to request approval of the various bond documents, and we'll walk through those toward the end of the presentation. Okay, so there has been no shortage of events in the market that have triggered some volatility. So tariffs are on and then they're off and not on again. And most recently, we've seen some conflict in the Middle East. With that said, we haven't seen near the scale of volatility that we were seeing back in April. You know, market movement is somewhat normal and expected. And up there in the top left bullet, I have some data points of where we've seen rates move since the last presentation on June 3rd. But rather than taking, you know, diving into those small immaterial movements there, I just want to highlight that rate movements are expected and will impact the total savings that we'll be able to capture from the refundings here in about 6 weeks or so. Up in the top right, I have the graph that we showed last time, the 30-year municipal rates compared to 30-year treasury rates, the treasury rate being in that light green line and the municipal rate in the dark green line. And then that vertical line there shows is the data beyond from when I last presented it. So that line is sort of the identifier from our last presentation there. So you can see the dark green line has stayed relatively stable and a little bit more volatility in the treasury rate. In the economic data, we've seen inflation has eased a little bit, and we've seen some early signs of weakening in the labor market, which could suggest some downward pressure on interest rates. However, as we talked about last time, with some of the uncertainty around tariffs and how that might impact the economy, we do expect the Fed to keep rates stable in the next couple of months. But again, economic data, of course, can always change. So,
and I did have, is it okay to ask
yes,
questions? I did have a question because you mentioned the Middle East issue. And let's say that were to escalate and might involve this country. Would that be something that would, I'm assuming it would affect this and we might change our schedule?
It could impact interest rates depending on, you know, the severity of the conflict.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, when the news initially came out, we saw a spike in interest rates, but it actually settled down pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And so the spike was associated with sort of inflation expectations. You know, we have an expectation that gas prices will go up, price of oil will go up, and that's reflected in those treasury rates. But you know, I think that the market must be somewhat used to shocks at this point.
Yeah, let's shrug your shoulders.
Yeah, exactly.
So I got my answer in that we're moving forward and we don't anticipate any big swing.
We don't at this time, but of course we're keeping our eye on things, and we've provided a lot of flexibility in the bond documents that we'll be bringing to the board for approval on July 1st to allow us to be nimble and adjust our timing if needed.
Yeah, I'm still bothered by the difference between the treasury and municipal, and I'm wondering if the difference would seem like it should be the tax rate, and I'm wondering if it's because Congress maybe is closer to extending the tax cuts. Would that explain why? It just bothers me to go out and buy if you think that's going to grow. You know.
The ratio is different depending on where you're at in the curve. So right here, we're looking only at 30-year municipal and treasury rates. So that ratio, the difference or the relationship between the municipal and the treasury, it is different at the 1-year rate versus the 10-year rate versus the 30-year rate. And, you know, as we talked about last time, really is a function of supply and demand. Hard to pinpoint to one exact thing that's driving the demand in the municipal market that's influencing those ratios. I will say that, you know, the treasury market is a lot more liquid. There are a lot more transactions and things are traded a lot more quickly. And so we see rates move
more quickly in the treasury market than we do in the municipal market, which is highlighted by sort of that stability that you're seeing in the dark green line versus the light green.
Okay. Because
investors like stability.
Yeah. Yeah, the flight to quality. And we did see that with the most recent news in the All right, so there in the bottom right, we just have a look at how numbers have changed since we last spoke on June 3rd. So up in the top, we have the new money. The interest rate has moved up ever so slightly, and the refundings, the savings on the refundings have actually improved. And you can see the 2010 Build America bonds or the BABs are now quote unquote in the money or in positive savings territory. And just a reminder again, you know, interest rates can move, and to the extent that they move away from us again, just a reminder that we did establish a $1 million loss threshold on those Build America bonds to eliminate the potential sequestration risk that's associated with them. Moving on to the 2025 new money structure. So we've structured, we're anticipating structuring the debt service to be a level debt service structure with a 2-year principal deferral. You can see that in the graph on the right-hand side. The bars are relatively flat across the life of the expected issuance. And then there in 2025 and 2026, you can see the absence of the dark green bar, which represents principal repayment on the bonds. And that's in alignment with our 2025 budgeted expectations. Eases some liquidity pressure on the front end while maintaining an affordable rate or affordable debt service structure over the life of the bonds. And this level debt service structure also helps to provide rate stability for our customers. Okay, and then in the bottom left there, we have a table with just some statistics for the 2025 issuance based on rates as of.
I'm sorry, I have a question. Yeah, do you think the interest rate is going to impact by everything that happens? And some point, or it's going to be stable in 4.721.
It will likely change. Interest rates change in the market every day. With that said, we don't anticipate significant movement in the market. So, you know, interest rates will move depending on economic data that's released. So inflation numbers, labor data, Fed rate movements, we'll see that reflected in interest rates. But when we go to the market, we do it strategically around those big dates when economic data is released so that we can provide more assurance around stability in the interest rates. So we could potentially see that rate move, but we don't anticipate it to move too significantly between now and the time we issue the bonds.
Thank you.
Move on to the next slide here. So this is a look at the aggregate debt service. So this is combined electric and generation system after all proposed transactions this year. So we just looked at the 2025 new money in isolation. This graph here shows the 2025 new money, which is represented by those yellow bars. The refunding debt service, so the 2010 and the 2015 anticipated refundings, the new debt service on those is represented by the dark green bars, and then the light green bars at the bottom represent the unrefunded debt service. So debt service where nothing is changing, those are the electric 2020, 2021, and 2022 bonds. The orange line there represents debt service as it stands today before any of those are future transactions. The difference between that orange line and the top of the dark green bars represents the savings, the cash flow savings on the refunding transactions. So you can see a bit of cash flow savings there, most significantly in 2036 through 2040.
I have a question on this page. Is our aggregate debt service fall within the board's governance policy on the, I don't remember that we changed it, but it's 40% and then there's some things that are taken out of that. So does it fall within that?
Yeah, so right now our leverage, so the percentage of our assets that have been debt financed is around 20%. The executive limitation four says we can't finance more than 40% of capital over a 15-year period, 10 years back and 5 years forward. For the 2025 budget, that was around 20%. And then in the next 5 years for our capital plan, we have a capital plan of about $1.1 billion over the next 5 years. And we're issuing $185 million to finance a portion of that. And that's only around 19% of the total capital plan.
Right.
So we're going to be maintaining that leverage of around 20%, which is really low relative to some of our peers.
And particularly in our industry.
Yeah. Good question. Thank you. Okay. This is another slide to sort of bring it all together. Looking at the net impact of the new money transaction and the refunding transactions. So the table up in the top right, apologize, the headers there are a little bit dark, but it's a formula of our current state, the addition of the new money in the column to the right, and then the reduction from the refunding transactions and the resulting expected debt service. So if we look at the middle line there, current outstanding debt is around $452 million. The new money transactions expected to add about $176 million to that, but then the refundings will reduce it by about $21 million. So net impact is around $156 million addition to our outstanding debt. And we'll be bringing in $185 million project fund to help finance our capital plan. In the bottom right table there, we thought it might be helpful to take a look at where we're seeing interest rates, how that's impacting the debt service schedules for the new money and refundings compared to what we had budgeted, what was in the approved budget for 2025, and then the associated forecast that was presented at that time. So the top two rows there represent debt service based on rates today with the new money and the refundings, and then the coverage that we're calculating based on our operating expenses that were budgeted and then forecasted. And then the middle two lines are the budget that was approved and the forecast, and then the bottom two lines there show the difference. So at current rates, we're expecting debt service and coverage to be improved from what was budgeted and forecasted at the end of last year. The net difference that we're seeing is an improvement of about $13 million over the forecast period. Okay, and then I want to spend a minute here talking about our debt service reserve fund obligations. So for some background, we typically issue additional bonds to fund a debt service reserve from that issuance. The debt service reserve historically has served as a security for our bondholders, and the reserve would have been about $9 million for the 2025 new money transaction. It's funded at max interest for the bond issuance, and that comes out to be about $9 million. After some discussion with our underwriters and our financial advisor and our bond counsel, we've determined that a reserve fund is no longer a requirement. We don't, yeah, so we have,
go ahead.
We've learned that a lot of our peers are actually highly rated municipalities, such as the district, are actually going away from funding debt service reserves, and they're not considered a requirement to price or market the bonds. So we don't anticipate there to be any adverse impact to the pricing of the bonds, the marketability of the bonds, or our credit rating by going away from the debt service reserve. And this really is a function of the district's high credit rating and our autonomy in setting rates and our ability to maintain the revenues that we need to service our debt.
Yes.
What about interest? Would there be any lack of interest in buyers of the bond?
We
I mean,
don't.
without seeing a debt service reserve?
Yeah, we vetted that with our underwriters who are in the market, you know, every day pricing bonds on behalf of municipal entities, and they've advised that they haven't seen any adverse impact to marketability of the bonds for a highly rated entity such as the district.
This is it. For some reason, I thought that this was in the bond documents that we maintained the debt service. It's not.
So it has been noted
I'm
in
sorry to dwell on this.
No, it's a great questions and all, you know, it was something new for us as well. And something that we, you know, we had an extensive conversation with our external bond counsel to review our existing bond documents to ensure that eliminating the reserve wouldn't be in conflict with our existing covenants. And they confirmed that it's not. The language in the bond documents, in the supplemental resolution and the preliminary official statement that you'll see here in a couple of weeks, will say that the 2025 bonds are secured by a separate reserve and the reserve requirement is $0. And that ensures that we're, you know, in compliance with our existing bond documents. So we will maintain a debt service reserve for the bonds that are not being refunded. So the 2020, 2021, and 2022 bonds, those were secured by a reserve at that time. So we can't change that reserve. We can't eliminate that reserve. So we'll be keeping that. But for bonds on a prospective basis, we're no longer requiring a debt service reserve fund.
Pile of cash.
It is. So it's $9 million that will directly reduce the 2025 new money issuance. That's about $18 million in total debt service that will save over the life of those bonds. And then we also have the 2010 and the 2015 bonds that are being funded. So we'll be able to reduce the reserve that we have that was related to those two bond series. About $14 million under the electric system and about $4 million under the generation system. And those dollars will be able to be used to pay debt service and or reduce the size of the borrowing for the 2025 issuance. So a direct positive impact to our liquidity.
Thank you.
All right, so timeline and next steps. So we'll be back on July 1st to request approval of the supplemental resolution. So because we're issuing under the electric and generation systems, we'll be bringing two supplemental resolutions, one under each system. Within those supplemental resolutions, they will approve the form and the distribution of one or more preliminary official statements, the form of one or more bond purchase agreements, and then we'll delegate the authority to the treasurer or CFO to execute the bond documents at the time of the deal. Since I pulled these slides together, our timeline has shifted out a couple of weeks. So we're now expected to price the bonds all together on July 24th. So the new money and the refunding transactions will all be priced at the same time on July 24th. If you remember last time, we talked about the nuance of the Generation 2015 bonds, because they're not callable until December 1st. There's regulatory constraints around when we can close that transaction. So we'll be pricing them together, but we'll be closing them on separate dates. So the new money transaction and the 2010 refundings will be closed on July 29th. We'll know the results of all the transactions. So we'll be back on August 5th to brief the board on the results of that sale. And then we will be closing the 2015 refundings on September 3rd. And that's all I have. Any questions?
No. What are the new bonds callable? Who are they called?
Yes, and they'll be callable that have a 10-year call. So the refunding bonds and the new money bonds will be tax exempt and will all be callable in 2035.
But interest rates drop.
Yeah. Absolutely.
No.
Thank you.
Of course.
Thank you.
Great job, Lauren. All right, next up is our customer service regulations for electric service update. Don.
Also known as new gun.
Well, 14 months.
Gun
gun. I'm not going to know. He's right there. Good morning. We're gonna keep moving forward. Again, John Hoffman, your Chief Customer Officer. Great to be with you this morning. I'm gonna be turning it over to Ryan in just a moment, a little bit about how we got here to the point of I have been here for around 14 months. And one of the things that I first was exposed to was we had a customer who was repeatedly calling the same employee with behavior that I would qualify as harassment. And unfortunately, we didn't have anything in our regulations that allowed us any recourse in that situation unless the customer made a threat. So challenged Ryan and Paul McMurray from our legal team and a variety of others to sit down and see if there were areas, particularly around safety and mental health, but also other areas of our regulations that could use updating. And that was the genesis for this presentation today. So without further ado, turn it over to Ryan, and a big thanks to Ryan for seeing this through.
Clarification. So this is the sole focus of this update?
Of this update, yes. You'll see me again.
And the customer service rates were updated.
June 1st, 2023.
Well, thank you. I didn't want to hear 10 years. Don't laugh, it has happened.
Thank you, John. As stated, my name is Ryan Newby. Good morning, Commission. It is my pleasure to present this information to you. And there is about 18 slides, and I'll do my best to power through. But if at any time you have questions, feel free to stop me. As shared, the purpose of our presentation here is to inform the Commission of proposed updates, edits, changes to our customer service regulations. And this presentation is for your information. A vote would be required in order to approve changes to our customer service regulations. And if you are all in agreement, that could take place as early as July 1st. So as far as what our customer service regulations are, very simply, it's our contract with our customers. It outlines how we will do business, how we will treat them for each and every circumstance that we encounter in the course of doing business. And it also lists out our fees and charges, what the district can and cannot charge for various situations that arise in the course of doing business with our customers. As shared with Commissioner Olson, they were last updated on June 1st of 2023. At that time, the key updates was really about addressing our AMI and adding Section 5 for non-standard service. We did add at that time an opt-out policy and procedure, and then implemented a temporary customer side repair policy. There were some fees and charges that were updated at our last update. I'm happy to report no fees are changing with this proposed update. I know this looks like a long list, but quite a few of these are updates to our customer service regulations so that they will appear online very easily for our customers who will access them at snowpud.com. So you'll see in some of the highlights there that a lot of the links and pages that customers will land on have been updated just to make it easier for our online experience. Our first major change that we have proposed is in 1.1A, which really outlines how a customer can apply for service. And the keys that we've added here give clarity to both the district and all prospective customers, not just individuals, but businesses, corporations, partnerships. We do business with living trusts. And so quite a bit of content was added right up front in 1.1A to outline specific circumstances that we do encounter in the course of doing business with our customers, such as the proof of the right to occupy a premise. It may not seem like much, but our customer service agents encounter a lot of landlord-tenant disputes. So by adding the proof of rights to occupy a premise, it will help the district better treat our customers fairly and give us guidance on how to handle those customers and setting up those accounts.
What's premise defined as?
The place that you occupy, so your house, your condo,
So we could just walk in.
We've had disputes with unauthorized individuals.
Right, yeah, I understand the issues, but we can just walk in, huh? I'll drop the question. But we can
just... Fair enough. 1.1C is a new addition. And this is an important update because as Chief Customer Officer Hoffman shared, he will be up here presenting a proposed new collections contract update and the way in which PUD hopes to do business by outlining how we're going to handle customers who have an inactive account that's been unpaid and speeding up the collection of that in order to help those customers get back into service. But also gives the district a little bit more protection with customers that have repeatedly been sent to collections and have an outstanding, large growing balance that's been unpaid. And the proposal will include having the customers take care of their collections contract balance prior to being able to sign for new service. So with questions for that, I would love to defer those to Mr. Hoffman at a later point. In section 1.4, this is one of those links that we have added in the customer service regulations. So our digital customers will be able to click on the link there and land right at the construction standards and the ability to know exactly what it will cost for line extensions. In section 2.2, we have simplified language. This was a very long paragraph. The content hasn't really changed, but we just legal recommended that we simplify the language to just drill down to our core business, which is sending notifications for bills and notices, whether it's by email or first class mail. We will meet the customers where they're at. There was a lot of language in our previous generation or previous version of the regs that called out the website, how things were going to be mailed or emailed electronically, but this just really cleaned it up.
You know, I've heard that sometimes customers who are not in a position or interested in paying bills won't take registered mail. Do we need to put in here registered or unregistered to cover that? Just a question.
Yeah. Well, I know that in dealing with Paul, he recommended first class mail was the way to go, but that's certainly something that can be modified if the commission would like to.
I'm not an expert.
You have to sign for
registered.
Everybody will sign.
I understand, but I guess I'm just saying, should we set the expectation that may be, I don't know if we ever use registered mail.
I think in special circumstances, we have required mail to be signed for when we're sending out legal documentation, but this was specifically just the general bills and invoices that we mail to our business and residential customers. This was a new addition, so I'd like to spend a little bit of time here. We're adding a new letter to 2.4 under customer facilities content, and specifically to address defective customer equipment that we discover. This was a section that was actually added later in our AMI policy under section 5. And we knew that as we were going to be installing AMI meters that we were going to discover things. And that's why we created the side repair policy. But both our metering superintendent and our AMI senior manager recommended that we put this into our regular regulations because after AMI is all done, we're still going to get those hot socket alarms that are going to let us know that there's a high temperature alert. And what we've already found in some of those examples of customers that have an AMI meter installed is that hot socket is because of defective equipment on the customer's side. So both in the course of doing business and for safety, being able to stop service in that moment, we'd like to have this added to our regular regulations moving forward, as it will help us navigate hot socket alarms. Very infrequently.
Okay.
My understanding was less than 0.5%, but when they do come up, they're serious because it means they're overheating.
I think the new meters can work with that, so it may come up more often.
Absolutely.
The meters are deployed.
That's the primary purpose to
include
this. We will have awareness of those.
We'll be getting that information and metering will be responding to those and This helps us be able to disconnect the electrical service with our regulations. And if there's any questions by the customers, we are able to refer back to this contract and say, we have it here so that this is for your protection and the district's protection.
How many smart meters do we have outside?
The last dashboard I saw was 65,000 ballpark installed right now.
And now there's 65,000 that we have, how many issues we are dealing with?
Don't have that exact number, not being in the AMI department, but we do respond to those issues as they come up. So
okay.
Can I just quickly add something? We do have other.
We'll come up and get the microphone and introduce yourself. Thank you. You know who you are.
I want to volunteer if I want to have a I just wanted to add that this is a really good. We do experience other things like weather heads that'll have problems. You know, if you have a big storm and a tree falls on a service wire and then the weather head starts to come off. So this does apply for more than just meter issues that we have. And we do, I wouldn't say that they're very frequent, but we do have a fair amount of issues on the customer side from the attachment point all the way to the meter. So
please introduce yourself and your title.
Amy Carstens, I'm the Chief Operations Officer. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
I know who she was.
These titles are getting longer.
Well, that's for sure. Well, except for
Jason's.
We'll have more on our titles later in the presentation.
Are we anticipating that because it's the customer is being told that they have to fix it, we're going to turn the power off, which we have to because of safety. Do we anticipate customer pushback?
I think we've experienced customer pushback because a lot of times there's a lack of understanding in that moment, and there's that kind of fear of loss of the power. But most of our customer service agents are very quick to explain that this is a necessary repair to protect both them from further damage or loss or even fire. So most are very receptive once we've had that conversation.
I'd like to follow a comment. This misunderstanding is regarding technology or language issues or something. About the comment that Commissioner also mentioned, about the misunderstanding, like the people don't understand, or when you talk with the customers regarding the smart meters, is a lack of understanding in technology or lack of the language issues. So
it's not usually a language issue. The lack of understanding is usually nobody wants to have their power shut off. And so in that moment, there's a lot of times the pushback is, please don't shut off my power, I need it. But we need to shut it off in order to make repairs or have the customer make repairs and have the work done so that it's brought to code and safe for the customer to have power re-energized.
Thank you. We do weather heads.
It's customer responsibility.
But the significant advantage for AMI that we shouldn't really overlook is now we have a warning when these meter sockets are getting warm or hot. In the past, we haven't. I mean, it's usually by the time the sockets or the lugs get to a point where they melt down, now we've got an outage. That's how we're identifying that we had a heating issue. But then it's too late, then the power has to come off. This gives us much better opportunity to be proactive in identifying those potentials and addressing them before there's, even more cost to the customer, because again, some of this is going to be customer owned or customer repairs that they have to pay for.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is, because as we install each meter, we're inspecting the customer's connection, and we've already gone through the works where we can bring in an electrician to repair those. Customers should be in a really good spot.
Absolutely.
By the time when they get their meter.
Yeah.
It's for a while. Thank you.
The 2.9A is also just being clarified and simplified a little bit. The language in bold here to call out specific reasons coincides with 2.4. So we're just calling out if we do find defective or improperly installed or failed equipment or any faulty wiring that's beyond the point of PUD's responsibility, that we're calling that out, that those would be a condition where it could be hazardous. And since it isn't compliant with code or regulation or requirements, we would be disconnecting the service to protect the district. Again, it's very consistent with what we're recommending we add in 2.4. As far as 3.1 goes, we had just a vague reference in our old regulations to snowpod.com. This is a general link or specific link that's added to help customers who access our digital version of the customer service regulations land at a very clean page where they can access all of the rates, whatever type of business they would be looking for. I'd like to spend a little bit of time here. This coincides exactly with what Chief Customer Officer Hoffman stated, which is we're recommending adding a bullet to our list of reasons why we will disconnect service. And following COVID, we have had a few more encounters in the field with occupants and members of the community that aren't happy with us being there. Sometimes it can be a very contentious relationship trying to access our equipment on customer property. I want to preface this by saying this is very few and far between that this happens. However, both at the recommendation of John Hoffman and our security manager, Rob Beidler, this gives us a little bit more leverage to ask the customer to play nice, for a lack of better terms, with our people that are accessing PUD equipment on their property. Really, the only leverage that we have to hold customers accountable is to stop service. And so if we're repeatedly having our field staff, our servicemen, our metermen, our meter readers being harassed and not treated with respect while trying to work on customer equipment that our property interfaces with, we would list that as a reason for disconnection, as a cause. So I think it's very important, and I think it sends a very powerful message to our community about treating each other with respect, as well as all of our agents that will be visiting customer property.
Couple questions. In terms of our service reps, how often do they have to go out in terms of field selection?
Our field collectors are out working daily.
Daily?
Yep.
Oh.
Yep. We do disconnections for non-payment.
Yeah.
Is the priority of the work. Yeah, and then reconnections once customers have satisfied their bills.
Did they ever have to take a sheriff out with them?
We have had instances where we've needed a police escort. Mm-hmm. Yep, and we coordinate with Rob Beidler and security to set that all up.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Any of them have shop then?
The customers, our agents, or are you talking about the deputies? No,
I was out with a customer service. You don't like to talk about history, yeah. But I was out with a customer service rep. I hadn't been with the utility that long. And this guy came to the door with shock. Wow. We left.
We do. We do have quite a few communities that love to celebrate their right to bear arms. So we have seen them, but it's very... very few and far between that happens.
Did the customer service folks go out here?
We can have the option to pair up when we have a known issue with a customer. Okay. So we have a system that allows us to caution code an account when we know that somebody has brandished a weapon or made threats before. So there's a whole process that we go through for that.
I thank you very much for hosting your folks.
Absolutely.
So this proposed policy is for repeatedly harassing visitors employees. I'm wondering how you can handle incivility now when you have a customer who's uncivil to, let's say, a CSR. So I worked for a school district for a while, and we had a civility policy, and it was sort of like our thought work story. Someone was just truly uncivil, you can just cease the conversation. You really couldn't engage on the issue you're upset about until you've scheduled and met with like the superintendent. I'm sort of wondering how we, the AGM level, get involved, or how do we handle those? It's concerning that someone could repeatedly harass before we can apply policy, because some people can be pretty uncivil.
Yes, and so we do have processes and procedures in place. John Hoffman has been very supportive of taking customer escalations, but they typically don't go that high. When we have an escalated customer who's off, you know, for non-payment or threatening, where we would be a caution coding, myself and Rob Beidler from security gets involved. We do have conversations with customers, and we ask them to behave, and treat our people appropriately. We already have in the regulations that we need safe and clear access to every property. So we will cite that with customers who are find themselves off for non-pay and have made threats or are uncivil. And there have been times where we've kept them off until they're willing to talk to us appropriately and assure us that we can have safe passage on the property.
I would like to add something. Policies, they are so important, but I try to picture myself. I mean, like, to have a visual example, like, I'm a customer. If you come into my home because you're coming to reconnect my electricity, I'm going to be the most happy customer.
Absolutely.
But I cannot get it how people can get it upset because you are going to repair and reconnect the electricity and have energy in their home. So it's quite hard for me to picture that. I don't know. And collectors, maybe, I don't know, again, English is my second language. Those customers that you are going to knock the doors and try to collect, I try to understand if they are like me, right? I mean, the English is the second language. You don't understand why the people is in your home knocking the door. So that's something that I don't know how to, I would like to know, I'm just curious, that all these collections of collectors that you go outside, I believe it's so hard to have the desegregated data about how many people they are or they belong to other cultures. They maybe we don't understand why. And I say that because it happens in the city of Lynwood when I was a city council. We have this issue that many people in the community, they don't pay the water. And there was a big debt, like almost $1 million. And we tried to figure out what issues they were in place. There was the language, there was the, maybe they lost the email, maybe they changed. So there's a lot brainstorming there, but for it's really important to establish relationships. So.
Absolutely.
Can I just add one thing? Because Ryan is being very humble, but Ryan and Shauna Boser worked on a Clear Stop Work Authority policy for our staff for mental health. So if they're ever in a situation where they feel a conversation with a customer is not mentally safe, they are welcome to escalate that without reason. There doesn't have to be a swear exchange or threats or anything like that. Our leadership team does a fantastic job taking those calls and resolving those issues. And if they ever feel like the situation is unsafe for them, they are welcome to escalate it to me. They don't do that very often. They take it very easy on me, but absolutely, we have Clear Stop Work Authority.
That's good.
In person on the phone.
Yeah. Oh, in person and on the phone.
Thank you.
As well as in the field. So our field agents, if there's anything that feels off or unsafe, safety has directed, we can fall back and regroup and come at it another way, another day, and potentially even with a police escort or security escort. So
good.
Stop Work Authority has been evident and championed through all. Out the entire department.
Yeah, and it erring on the side of caution, right, on safety. If there's any doubt at all, just leave the premises and call Ryan or others to help. I do want to, though, address your comments and question, Commissioner Polito, Altamirano, probably that by the time an account or a customer would get to the point where we're going out to disconnect their power, which is typically when and Ryan can correct me, but that's typically when we would encounter potentially aggressive customers. That's been a long process with numerous conversations from our customer service reps to truly try to get the customer to a good place, help them on budget, you know, payment plans or recovery plans to get them caught up. So there's been a lot of work, but there's some customers who still will be in a bad place when our folks go out to disconnect them. Those are really the situations that we're talking about that can potentially get elevated. We would want to, you know, have a police escort or at least a buddy system for folks to go out there. But with AMI and our ability to disconnect remotely, and that's really what this is. That's a safer way. If we've ever encountered a hostile customer, we can now disconnect, or the policy would give us the right to disconnect their power until they're ready to play fair, play nice.
Well, thank you. And I really appreciate all your efforts at SIAC. I can imagine that you expose them, you know, what customers behave and that out. So when a customer call, make a phone call here, do we have something in recorder, like the, when you call Alaska or Delta, whatever line, you know, and it's like, this call is monitored on recorder, and then you freak out, you know, because you're like, oh my gosh, it's going to be the recorder. I mean, I'm sorry, but it's true. So do we have that and here? Like, okay, thank you, because that might help too. So, okay.
And do the representative, our customer representatives, don't they make notes in the customer's records if there is a language issue? They used to anyway.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Every time we employ like our language line solutions and interpreter services, we document that in our interaction records.
Thank you so much.
Two questions. All right. This one is an update that's really more of a clarity.
We missed the last one.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm wrong.
We have
someone. Oh, this one.
Here.
Yeah, no, okay.
Yeah.
Want me to go back? No,
I'm sorry. No. So in 3.7e, this content has already been present in our customer service regulations. We did change the format by updating the bullets and called out our specific practice. It has been our practice to take measurements during our winter months at 8 a.m. So the bolded language in the first bullet of by no later than 8 a.m. is taking that measurement has helped the district navigate cold days. Usually by the time 8 o'clock rolls around in the winter, it's warmed up to however warm it's gonna be. So we've just found that to be a proper number for us. And then we've changed a little bit of language in the third bullet to update with the National Weather Service's heat advisory, and they changed their language to extreme heat watch. So we've added that here. This way, it's just very specific, easy to read for our customers, knowing when and how PUD will respond to weather-related events. We have made an update to section 3.10 for security deposits. Specifically, the bolded bullet at the bottom was the biggest addition. And we, in doing business with living trusts, partnerships, entities that are not actually a person, our legal department recommended us to add language specifically addressing if we're unable to verify the credit worthiness of an entity or an organization. And that's because like a trust or a living trust can be very difficult to collect upon if it becomes insolvent. So it protects the district up front by being able to require a deposit. Our business manager also requested to one small change to change how long we hold a deposit for business customers from 24 months to 12 months to match our residential policy.
This is a little off topic, but I'm curious. I have no idea how many of our customers are required to have a security deposit. How most customers show us that they're a good credit risk.
We do run a basic credit check for our residential customers. And then for business accounts, there's a process that we follow for verifying their business identifiers
at the state secretary's office.
Well, that triggers it if we don't get that.
We can't verify that a business is actually doing business with the state, then we require the person to take personal responsibility.
Okay.
We have to be able to verify
that. And so for new accounts, completely new customers, there's no deposit.
Not if they have a great payment history with other utilities, or if we're able to verify their credit history through our internal means.
I brought a letter for one utility by the state 31 years ago. It worked. 31 years ago, it worked. Yeah.
Section 3.13, this is unofficially the John Hoffman update. Our former title was Assistant General Manager. Like our chief customer service officer, we've added his title in there. So that's really the only change there.
Word service isn't there.
What's that?
The word service isn't
there. It's in the official document that you'll receive prior to voting. This is just a very small update. There was a prior reference in section 4.2 of our regulations outlining height requirements if a pole attachment was going to be allowed, but since the district is intending to prohibit any attachments to our poles, it's been cleaned up to reflect that top bullet. And then our final proposed update is section 5.3. We have requested that we remove March of 2026 from the information that's listed in our prior version of CS regulations, as we anticipate the project will continue into 2027, and the actual end date will depend on our supply chain as well as other factors. I know we've taken a lot of questions and a lot of time, but
bring them. I don't have any questions. Thank you.
Does this require board approval, our customer service rating? Because there's fees involved. Okay.
Thank you.
I have a quick question, and you may not know the answer, but it dawns on me as we roll our meters out, our customer interactions are going to diminish almost nothing. We won't have meter readers, so I can imagine that when we do have them, they may be more challenging. Right, people spend a tree in front of their meter, or they're just not used to ever seeing a unique vehicle employee walking through their neighborhood. Do you have any experience or do we know anything about how other utilities, how these things have gone post rollout of smart meters?
It's something that we're discussing, but I'll hand it off there.
Yes, you have brought up a very timely topic. So we actually just had a utility roundtable here at the district where we hosted the utilities from Western Washington, and this was one of the roundtable topics. What we have heard both from those utilities in Washington that have already rolled out AMI as well as others throughout the country is that there is an inspection program that most utilities will develop where you are still going out and inspecting that you have access to the equipment and that it's still safe on some kind of regular schedule. And what we were hearing was that regular schedule is probably right around 2 years is where our neighbors are at. So yes, absolutely. We would have a lot less contact out in the field, but we would still be a presence in the community. It would just be on that inspection for access and safety basis.
And then, I
love those questions.
They are members for John's
one of my favorite kind of questions.
Thank you very much.
Great job, Ryan. Okay, next up.
Well, I have my question. So, you know, we've in social media in the last couple of storms, we've really emphasized people connecting properly the generator to not backfeed illegally or unsafely. So is there anything in these rules that are set about doing that? Or a customer agrees to our service, do they agree not to illegally backfeed into their system or unsafely backfeed?
There are specific requirements and costs associated with any damage that comes as a result to PUD equipment, where customers are held liable for actual cost of repairs should they hook up any apparatus or equipment that damages our facilities. But as far as generators specifically, since usually they're not, you know, installing those or adding those until power's out, we don't specifically call that out in the CS regulations.
Thank you.
Do that.
And I would assume that there those regulations are in the NESC codes, because those are connected behind the meter. Yeah.
John's point, I believe they're in our electrical service requirements.
Yeah.
For interconnecting with our facilities.
Yeah, but probably not in this.
But you know, some are being sold on TV. And yet someone informed me that one of the brands.
Again, great job, Brian. That's good stuff. Next up, Don Hoffman, again, in the collection contract and process changes.
I am just really happy that Allison is on a needed vacation, because she'd be giving me side eye about it being 10 already if she were here. So, John Hoffman, Chief Customer Officer, here to talk about changes we would like to make to our collections processes. In a moment, I'm also going to be introducing Jennifer McMatt, who is with Audit and Adjustment, to talk a little bit about the company. Our goal here today is to inform you of our selection of Audit and Adjustment for being our collections partner for the next 3 years. We would also like to outline some of the collection processes changes that we intend to make. Because the collection contracts are a little different than regular contracts, because we don't pay Audit and Adjustment anything, they collect the cost for their services from the customer. It doesn't go through the traditional contract approval process. We still feel we have a duty to inform you about the contract and these process changes, which is why we're here today. Again, there'll be no action you need to take other than the piece that Ryan talked about, which will be coming before you on July 1st for the customer service regulations. So a little bit of scope before we get started, because a lot of people misunderstand what accounts we're talking about. So to be very clear about the accounts, we're quite conservative in our approach on which accounts we send to collections. We only send accounts that have been final billed and we have exhausted our recovery efforts. So this is not customers we're currently working on with installment plans or to get assistance for. These are customers who either those installment plans are failed or they've never reached out to us to begin with. These accounts will be a minimum of 87 days old since they were turned off. So again, no one here has current services. These are all customers that have left our service territory or have moved somewhere in the service territory and have not taken on new service. But that can go 155 days plus, depending on the scenario. So for some of these customers we're talking about, they've had 5.5 months and have still not made payment. All customers would receive a minimum of 3 notices, could be 7 or more notices depending on the situation. And again, we have no payment arrangements in place. So these are what we would consider to be customers we cannot get in contact with. So background about why we're doing the new contract with ANA. We were notified on July 14th of last year that one of our two vendors, Nationwide Recovery Services, or NRS, had a security incident. And while that is being worked on separately with our ITS group on making sure that we are following the processes for recovery with our customers, it did cause us to go back and look at the contracts. And what we found was, to Commissioner Olson's point about, you know, sometimes things aren't always updated in a timely fashion, these contracts have been in place since 2013. And in fact, both of them were expired at that time. And part of that just goes back to, again, these contracts aren't traditional contracts and how they are approved. So it did lapse, but obviously we need these services. So we worked with legal to do a 1-year contract with ANA to continue services. And then we did a nationwide RFP.
to see what vendors were out in the space. As part of that effort, we did identify multiple ways that we could be more effective, and that's why we're here today to talk about those process changes. So speaking of being more effective, you're going to learn shorthand about when I present versus when members of my team present. We do a lot of really exciting, cool things in customer and energy services. And I love for my team members to be able to come and talk to you. It's kind of like a form of recognition to get to share the exciting updates that they're doing. Sometimes, though, there are things we need to work on, and that's when you'll see me. So congratulations that I'm presenting this to you today. So in terms of collections, we have sent $16.3 million over the last 4 years to our collections partners. They have returned about $1.57 million in principal. Now, every collection vendor would tell you this isn't how they calculate their collection rate, but this is my simple math. That means that we've gotten 9.6% of our principal back. We are targeting a 20% rate. We've talked with other utilities. We've looked at benchmarking. It's a stretch goal, but it is a reasonable target. And that would have equated to an additional $1.7 million in revenue. And if I were Jeff Bishop, this would be my favorite $1.7 million possible, because no rate had to be increased, no fee had to be charged, no power had to be purchased. This is just about collecting from customers who already agreed that that was what they would pay for the services they received. So with that in mind, a little bit about how our individual partners did during that time period. I do want to call out again, I believe it is our practices that are driving them under the 20% target, and we'll talk about those process changes. However, under the same conditions, we saw ANA return almost twice what NRS did during that time period. So even if we had done nothing else other than just go with ANA, we would have seen a quarter more recoveries during that time period.
I know our folks do an excellent job, but is maybe part of that reason that we try to do it ourselves for the next two? Okay.
You are teeing me up perfectly. Thank you. Yes, we will absolutely talk about that. We will. I'm sorry.
Question. What kind of customers do we are talking about it? That residential or homes?
It follows our customer mix. So the vast majority of them are residential. But it is pretty consistent with our actual customer mix. So there is some commercial.
The percentage?
I'm sorry, I don't, but I can get that.
Thank you.
Good question. So we'll talk about the five changes we'd like to make. One, having a single contract with ANA. We'll talk about removing social security numbers out of our system. We'll talk about leveraging those that might have more expertise in this than we do with pre-collections. Restructuring our fees, and then the new service requests that Ryan touched on already. So the first one at this point should be no surprise. We are recommending that we select audit and adjustment for our contract for the next 3 years. We did do a nationwide RFP. We did have seven different vendors that were qualified that went through that process. We evaluated them in three areas that we used in 2013, being the quality of their services, their collection rate, their assigned staff, and references. New this time though, we also evaluated their self-service options, because customers are increasingly expecting self-service options. And particularly if it's an embarrassing debt scenario, they may feel more comfortable going online and doing it there instead of having to call or talk to someone. And we also looked at pricing. And this was not without controversy, because again, technically we don't pay it. So technically we could say pricing doesn't matter to us, but these are still our former customers. We want them to have a great experience. So we wanted to make sure the pricing was competitive as well. One thing I want to highlight is that in that list, nowhere is their location. We treated everyone the same in terms of their evaluation, whether they were in Linwood or Tallahassee. We did not give credit for whether they were in our service territory or not. From this process, ANA significantly outscored all respondents. In fact, we had intended to do two contract issuings. And when we got the RFP team together, there was simply no point. ANA provided a significantly better service. And I think that that is in part because They are in our backyard, and we have had a long history with them. So they were willing to go above and beyond what other providers were willing to provide us. And to that end, I'd like to invite Jennifer up now to tell us a little bit about ANA, located in beautiful Lynnwood, Washington.
Yes, we are.
Very welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
And it's nice to meet all of you. I'll just tell you a little bit.
Sorry. Mm-hmm.
I'm shorter than you.
Sorry.
Lord. Anyway, my name is Jennifer McNatt, and I am the president of Audit and Adjustment Company. And our office is located in Lynnwood, Washington. We've always been in Lynnwood since 1996. So we have almost been in business 30 years. So we're super excited about that accomplishment, especially going through COVID and all of that, as a collection agency not being able to be open during that time. So we have a rock solid agency, and some of our clients include a lot of, we collect for Snohomish County PUD for the past 10 years. And we also have a number of large healthcare systems located within Washington State, Oregon, California as well. We do have clients across the United States. However, primarily most of our large clients are located within Washington. What that means for the PUD is it allows us to have different types of debt already loaded in our system. So a customer may have a debt with PUD, but also with another one of our clients within Washington State, and that on the account that we're already working. And so we utilize that information. We may have updated address, phone number, and information on that account to allow us to assist in the collection of your debt. The number one issue with the debts that we receive from PUD is the information isn't valid any longer. We don't know where the consumer lives. We don't really have a phone number any longer. And so that is the most important piece of information that we need to obtain in order to recover your debts. Our collectors, that's the first thing we do. The collectors send the accounts out for a skip tracing, and then we obtain new information to help us recover your debts. And we do that in a way that provides a customer service aspect to your customer. So it's the collector's responsibility to figure out why the customer hasn't paid their debt. There's always a reason. Very few people just don't want to pay. So they either didn't open their mail, they are going through a hard time, they need lower payment arrangements, but it's our responsibility to have that conversation with the customer to determine the best way to recover the debt for PUD. So that's in essence what we do for you. We're working as an agency to reach out to the consumers in the way that they want to be reached out to, meaning mail is old school. We have to move to email and texting and speak to the consumer in the way that they want to be spoken to. We find that it's increasing recovery rates to email out notices, to text out notices, to text payment links to consumers so that they can just click on their phone and go, and it directs them to our online payment portal, and they can input their credit card information and the debt's paid. So as an agency, we're reinvesting in technology. We find that our debtor base is getting younger and younger. So we have to communicate with a 24-year-old differently than you would communicate with me. Let's not go there. But you get it. So we have to communicate with people the way they want to be communicated with. And so as an agency, that's something we're moving towards and that we're helping our clients move towards as well.
I have one question for you. So if you have, let's say someone owes a PUD $2,000 and that's been given to you, and you've got a local medical business that you're with a customer, and they have a bill of $2,000, as you go to collect that $4,000, how does, if you're able to collect, how does that money get allocated? Does the customer decide which bill they're going to?
They have the right to decide. So that is one way they can tell us where to apply the funds to, but the first account in is the first account paid. That's how it works. It's the only fair way to do it. But we definitely have customers say, I want you to pay this bill first.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And what kind of tools do you have for non-traditional customers?
So as far as locating a customer?
No, as far as Snohomish is so diverse, I'm talking about non-traditional customers, meaning belong to different cultures. Snohomish, they speak like,
lots of different
100 languages. Plus, according with Edmonds School District, 100 plus languages. So I'm wondering, because we are not traditional customers, people sometimes they have a lack of literacy and technology. Even though that you send the link, they are not going to go to the link, and they are not able to, even though they have smartphones. That's my question. How do you reach out to those customers?
So we also employ Spanish speaking collectors, but if they're in a language other than Spanish or English, we employ an interpreter service that can translate for us in hundreds of different languages, Arabic, hundreds of different languages. And so every person at Audit and Adjustment Company has access to this service. We also have notices that are translated into different languages. So our website can also, our pay site can also be flipped to Spanish. But also we can take our payment over the phone as well with the help of the interpreter service. So they have the capability to communicate with us.
I mean, it's nice that you have that in place, but sometimes as good intentions versus being intentional. And I said that in the matter because even though that you have your website in other languages, I mean, people don't reach our websites. Even though that you have a translation in other documents, people sometimes, they are not able to read and write their own language. So if you want to be effective, I mean, sometimes, I mean, we communicate, our communication is better if you make a phone call. And there's that you talk with the person, the real person. If you guide them or meet with them, it's like, okay, I'm going to meet with you and I'm going to help you to go through with this process and modeling how you can access in that in the smartphone. And also WhatsApp, I mean, we don't use the traditional message and phone. So it's all that because if we want to really, I mean, do the relationships building with those they are in this list as a client. And I say that not in a negative way. I mean, it's how we can address it this better.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. The majority of our communication is via phone, one-on-one or through the interpreter service, collector to the customer. And they spend a lot of time going through the issue with why they're not paying the bill. And we work to assess their financial situation so that we can make payment arrangements that they can afford at this time. Maybe they can afford more in the future, but we go through and assess their situation. Maybe it is just a misunderstanding why they can't pay the bill, but that's why you hired us to figure that out for them. And so they do all of that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
Me too.
That's great. Yeah.
So in addition to having the single contract with us, we also are planning to remove Social Security numbers from our system entirely. This will be by the end of the year. Again, we were notified of that security incident with NRS. And while this was something we had already wanted to do, it kind of prioritized making that more important. So we use Social Security numbers in a variety of ways today. One is to verify an account. That is a option to verify an account, or we also can use picture ID. And we also then provide that Social Security number today to our collections partners if someone does not pay, so that they can use the credit bureaus to locate that customer. What we would be doing in the future is we would still be using Social Security number as a option for account validation. We again have other options for those that do not have Social Security numbers. But after that initial account opening, at the end of the night, all Social Security numbers in the system will be deleted. So we will not retain Social Security numbers other than just intraday use. We will also collect date of birth from the customer, and that will be supplied to the collection to ANA for the purposes of using the credit bureau. So it's still sensitive information, but it's not at the same level of sensitivity of Social Security number. And this is a big win for us because it still allows ANA to do their full collection activity and allows us to reduce the risk of having Social Security numbers in our system.
Isn't it going to hamper collection?
It should not, because again, as long as they have the unique identifier of date of birth and then along with address and name, they can do their processes. So this is related to both both commissioners' comments, because I agree completely. There are times when we have not connected with customers. And a lot of times that could be language barriers. That could be that we, as Jennifer teed up very well, we often don't know where they've moved. Almost all of our tools to find a customer are related to a customer who moves within the service territory. If you move to Tallahassee, I'm not going to be able to find that address. And nor do I want my team to spend a whole lot of time on the internet trying to Columbo people down. So we are going to rely on the experts on this with something exciting called pre-collections. I'm going to try to stay out of a lot of the weeds on this, but essentially anyone who's involved in collections can tell you that the older an account gets, the less likely you are to recover it. And I think there has been a historic thought process at the district that we want to give more time and more notices as the friendly thing to do. The problem is, again, we often don't know the customer's new information. So giving more time by sending more notices to an address the customer's not at anymore doesn't help anyone. So what we have agreed with ANA is this idea of pre-collections. For the first 30 days that we placed with them, they will use their tools to identify the new location of the customer. They will make at least 2 contact attempts during that time period. And if the customer pays, it will be a flat $20 administrative fee to cover ANA's time. There will be no collection fee assessed. It won't be impacting their credit bureau report. So for those customers we have not connected with, when they do get a reach out at their new address, finally, because it has gone to ANA, we can say, sorry, we didn't have your new information. As long as you pay within this 30 days, no harm, no foul, we move on and you have your $20 administrative fee.
What time period? I know there's several notices that customers can get, and we're pretty lax on that. Well,
Everyone's going to think I paid you to ask these questions, Commissioner Olson. So this is a great question. Let's talk about what time period. So first, this gets really confusing. I'm going to try to stay out of the weeds because there are situations where someone will have service and stop paying and we have to disconnect them. And then there's a final invoice process. And there are times when customers just don't pay their final bill. So there's actually 2 processes in play here. The first one is this situation where customers stop paying and we do have to unfortunately disconnect them. This process will remain exactly the same, and it will be around day 60 that person would be eligible for disconnection after receiving 4 different attempts to collect. One thing that has already changed that I want to make sure we call out is the new digital urgent notice. So we're making sure that we're making contact now with customers in 2 different channels. All the rest of the process are mail, but if you are a My Snowpud customer, we'll be sending you either an email or a text as well at that urgent notice stage. So a new thing we've added for all of our customers. Once the account is final invoiced, this is what will change. So our current world today, we wait 87 days to send the account to ANA. Again, that is 87 days in addition to the 68 days you might have already had. So this is where we get up to 155 days or 5.5 months before you are sent to the collection company. We do send 3 notices
during that final invoicing time period. Again, probably not to your new address. And so what will change in this process is that we will compress the time that we handle that account and send it to ANA on day 52. And then that goes into, they'll use their skip tracing tools, they'll send their two contact attempts. So we're not substantively changing the number of days that a customer will have before they will get a collection fee. But what we are doing is giving them a fighting chance to pay in that 30 days with the new contact information that ANA has.
So the new timeline, day zero starts with what?
Day zero would be the day the final invoice is sent.
Okay. So on the previous graph.
So yes, on the
same day zero.
No, the invoice sent on this graph is for a customer who currently has services. So zero on the next graph is day 68 on this graph.
So if you can go to the next mm-hmm. slide, I guess my question is, are we where we should be in this world we live in? As far as, you know, I'm sure people are much more mobile than they were mm-hmm. when we first started doing this.
We're going to be watching this very closely to see how it helps with our collection activity. It is my strong hope that we have now this new incentive for people to pay within this 30-day window. And if we're seeing that, then yes, we might continue to refine this and get it over to ANA even sooner in the process. So we are looking forward to seeing what the results will be.
I'm naive. What happened after the 5 attempts to contact the customer and you don't have any?
So at day 83, the standard collection process would happen. At that point, a collection fee would be assessed to the customer. ANA may or may not work with the credit bureau, and they would continue to try to contact the customer from that point forward.
Thank you.
Industry standards, I know, but customer care is extremely important for the OCD. But are these the timelines pretty standard?
No, I think we are very conservative in our collections process.
Being generous.
Meaning that we take a while. but this is, again, a good first step for us to see. And if we get positive response in terms of payment without negative customer pushback, then we should continue to explore it. And speaking of incentives for our customers, our current process right now, both NRS and ANA assess a 30% principal balance collection fee and a 1% monthly interest that we split in half. In the future, we want to structure all this to encourage prompt payment. So the customer who pays within that 30 days gets the flat $20 fee. Those customers who pay after the first 30 days will get a new fee that will be 24%. So it is still less than they are paying today. And part of that is we have restructured it so that ANA will get the full 1% interest and will stop the administrative challenges of splitting interest. Also too, our goal continues to be that we would want to collect long before we ever get into an interest scenario. Like, that's our goal, is to even not even be in that bucket.
Have a question, I'm sorry.
No, please.
Let's put an example in one scenario that you call a customer to try to collect the money, and that customer has a reduced launch program, the keys and everything. Are we gonna use a slate scale and order line to make the deal and say, hey, you can apply in the school, and then maybe you didn't even know, but exceeds this.
The rate would be standard because, again, at this point, we are well into that process. So that customer who calls us because they do need assistance or they are on some other form of assistance, again, we would work with them before ever sending the account to ANA.
Okay, thank you.
So new service requests, this is last but certainly not least. Again, I think we use a very conservative process to our collections today. Now, in fairness, legally, we cannot assist ANA in the recovery of debt. And that's a state
thing. That's not anything that we can change. However, we have taken what I believe is the most conservative interpretation of that, which means that when a customer comes back into our service territory, we pretend like that debt didn't exist, and we just open up a new account for them and start new service. And there are ways that other utilities deal with this, and we are recommending to move to the way that other utilities in our state deal with this, which is we are not going to assist ANA in the recovery. We are confident in their ability, but we're not going to extend new credit until that is paid off. So it's that piece of, you know, however long it takes or whatever process they follow or whatever arrangements they need, but we're not going to extend new credit to that customer if they've had that debt in the last 6 years. Now, we'll go ahead.
Don't you have a high percentage of customers that jump from apartment to apartment, try to get service?
Yeah, I don't have numbers on the churn, but yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So a little bit, because of course, when we talk about this, I think everyone's first thought goes to hardships, and there will be hardships in the scenario. So I want to call out first and foremost, we have every confidence that ANA is providing a great service experience. That's why we're continuing to do business with them. And so the very first thing is ANA working with them on that hardship situation. If that doesn't work, having had this before at Tacoma Public Utilities, I can tell you there's this concept of alternate account ownership. Most of our customers that are income constrained are not living by themselves. Housing is just too expensive for someone who's income constrained to have their own apartment or their own home. And so in those cases, if tenant A and tenant B are calling us and tenant A has a collection account, we can continue to open up the account for tenant B and notify them. Tenant A can be added as soon as they resolve their account with ANA. So now we're getting tenant B to help us collect from tenant A, but we are not involved in that process. So they would still have service, but we would not continue to accrue debt with tenant A. And then we do finally have the option in extreme hardships to pull an account back. If we have, for example, St. Vincent that would pay off an account entirely or something like that, we would have that option still remaining.
I'm confused. So with the example you just gave, by the time it's gone to ANA, the power has been disconnected, right?
Correct.
So the alternate account would be starting power back up.
So let's look at an example, because I happen to have that.
Do I get credit for?
You do. You do. You also get credit. So unfortunately, I don't have, because of the fact that we just considered a new account, I don't have good data on how often that happens. Yeah. I wish I could come to you and tell you. So I asked our collections desk, can you find an example? Just watch and see if you have an example of someone coming back into the service territory who has a collection debt and sent it to me. 20 minutes later, they sent me this customer. And also made it very clear, this is a common occurrence. So this customer had utility service from August of 2012 to September of 2014. They had their final invoice and one additional invoice that they did not pay. They owed us $160.77. I don't know where they went for the next 4 years. But then in January of 2018, they came back. And again, we said, welcome, we will extend you all new credit. And in this case, they had four invoices that went unpaid before they left for $328.72. I don't know where they went between March and December, but I know in December they were back. And this was during COVID. They never paid once on their account that entire time. They had $1,377.43 in a final balance. Again, there was a small time period where they were gone, and then they came back in December of 2021. Again, four invoices went unpaid. That's how long it took for us to get them disconnected, $442.24. So this customer is up to $2,309. And I know of this example because they just came back and we just gave them new service again.
A deposit.
Shauna would point out that there may have been a deposit requested.
But this is, and I want to be clear, I don't blame this customer. This is a fault in our process. Had we addressed this at the $160 level, we probably would have never gotten to the rest of these situations. In fact, I shared with you last time, I am an apartment dweller. And one of the things that has changed between now and 1996, when I was in an apartment the last time, is that they require you to provide a letter that you are eligible for utility service. Like, this is a common thing that other utilities are doing, and that, and the rental market has adapted. So our customers will be able to adapt too, but this makes sure that we don't just continue to extend credit.
So I have a question, because we have a new tool that we will be able to use as we roll out our smart meter, pay as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we on that? And does that help resolve when a customer is not paying? Let's say they're able to pay and they're just choosing not to pay.
Yeah, I would.
If you have a customer like this, can we require enrollment? Or
I would absolutely love to have a prepaid program. Works very well. I've had it in the past. It works very well for customers, particularly if they are gig workers that might have non-standard income coming in. It allows them, you know, I worked once with an Uber driver. He loved being able at the end of his night to just be able to put $15 on his account. Worked great for him. And yes, it would also allow us to say, in these cases, we can take that debt and put it into a prepay account, and 30 cents on every dollar, or a quarter on every dollar, will go to paying that back. So absolutely, it is one of the rates that both was part of the AMI business case that we want to be able to put on that. It's also on the rates roadmap with our rates team. I don't know the exact timeline of when we're expecting that to launch, though.
And I guess I'm wondering, if we have a customer that we just are like this, or we have a history, we know had a problem collecting from them. If we had a program like that, would that be a household that we would like put a meter on sooner rather than later?
Right now, we are not
yeah.
deploying meters differently based off of payment behavior. And that's an efficiency thing for being able to replace all the meters on a particular route.
Sure, so, I understand.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Other questions for him?
Thank you. Oh, I could come up with a bunch. I have no.
Yeah, great presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you. John, let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back at 10:47. We are back.
Okay, next up is our ongoing integrated resource plan phase 3, and I'll hand it over to Chris Scudder. Good morning, Chris.
Good. Sorry, I got to put this down. John's a lot taller than I am. good morning, commissioners. I'm Chris Scudder in the power supply department. With me, I have Michael Coe, who's going to be talking partially during this. Today, I want to talk about our phase 3 of the IRP, the integrated resource plan. The resource options. It's a really dense presentation today. So if possible, we could hold our questions to the end unless it's a clarifying question. We did allot some time at the end for some questions. So we'll take anything we can, but want to be cognizant of time. Today, we're going to start where we left off last time at the end of phase 2, talk about our phase 3, the resource options, and then a little bit of next steps. Today is informational only. We are not expecting any decisions from the board, but we are intending to solicit feedback on the resource options menu. Some headlines, overarching ideas. We are switching products in October to the load following product, and that does change how we think about an IRP and how we think about resources within that IRP. The 2025 IRP will be the first time that we are going to evaluate the district's future under the load following product. Load following does give us resource certainty and load service certainty, but we have options about how we serve that load in the future. So the IRP's fundamental question is, how do we identify the least cost and least risk pathway for load service for our customers? Under this guise, demand side resources, which is what Michael's going to talk about here in just a second, do provide some opportunities for us to reduce cost and reduce risk for the district. And then the core question of this IRP is going to be, what flavor of load service are we going to want? And that is whether we want BPA tier two power, which we'll talk about here at the end, non-federal resources, or a mix, and what the best path forward is. We do have some clean energy requirements under both I-937 or CETA, and those will be done in phase four. So those are included in the analysis. So picking up where we last talked to you back in April, this is kind of a graph that Landon showed about our future annual energy needs. This is kind of an annual energy look. The blue, purple, and orange are our tier one allocation, baseline conservation, and non-federal resources that we currently have. Those are essentially fixed, right? We are going to always have them. And what we're trying to solve for is the green area at the top. And that's going to be optimizing for new conservation, new tier two, and new non-federal resources for compliancy or for regulatory compliance and for cost. What's not shown here is demand management or peak management. We'll talk about that in a minute, but this is an annual energy look. I'm going to pass it over to Michael to talk about demand side resources first.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Michael Cove. I am Program Manager 4 in Energy Services. So I'm here to talk about demand side resources. And you may have heard Chris mention supply side resources. So if you're not familiar with either one of those terms, supply side is like our BPA products that we purchased or generation from Jackson. Demand side, I look at it as more of what our customers or the utility can do to manage those resources. So we have some tools available for us to determine some of these things. So we currently are working on our conservation potential assessment. I have our targets up here from our current targets that we have for our EIA, Energy Independence Act target, along with our clean energy implementation plan, which is a four-year target. And yes, there's a two-year target and a four-year target of conservation, and then 10-year potential. Just to point out, we've been doing conservation here at the district for over 45 years. We're very successful. We do it very well. And with the Energy Independence Act, we have set targets and met and exceeded those targets since 2010. The CPA is also a 20-year study, so that gives us information of looking out 20 years of what we can do. New to this IRP, we did a solar potential assessment. Part of that is feedback from our customers talking about when we were at our open houses, talking about the IRP, a lot of customers interested in having incentives for solar. Also the Northwest Power Conservation Council, which creates the regional power plan as part of the Northwest Power Act, has called out the solar, rooftop solar as a resource. Going forward, it does also called out of the 1980 Power Act as well that it is a resource. Region hasn't really treated it as such, but we're taking a look at it this year. Just to point out that we have over 5,000 installations of solar in the district, 50 megawatts of nameplate capacity. We do have 200 commercial installations and one industrial installation, so we do have quite a bit out there. And then we're going to talk about the demand response potential. I like to refer to it, this is my own personal goal of calling it out as the shared energy management, because as Commissioner Logan, you mentioned, when we move to AMI, we're going to have less opportunity to meet with our customers and see them. But with AMI, we also have the potential to work with them more. And in a demand response, that means the customer is going to have to do something or we have to do something. So working with the customer in order to get their buy-in and understand what's going on with this. So how do we find our cost-effective potential? So I manage the CPA portion. Looking at the blue boxes here, we come up with the technical potential, which is what's actually out in the world that we can do. And then we have the achievable potential, which tells us, barring any market or adoption barriers, what is available for us out of that technical. So there may be products in New York that's available, but we don't have them in our market. That's the technical. Achievable means they're in our market. What can we do to get those out there? So the CPA gives us the achievable potential. We take that information, turned over to the power supply team. It gets put into the IRP modeling software to make it cost effective. It comes up with what makes sense to us from an economic standpoint. And we split our achievable potential into 8 different cost bins based on megawatt hours, and mixes in annual and winter measures. I'll get into that in just a moment. And measures are across all our sectors. So here are 2 graphs, basically the same data, both left and right. The difference is on the left is our annual conservation. So those are items like commercial lighting that isn't impacted necessarily by seasonality. And on the right is our winter peaking conservation. So you think of heat pumps or insulation, windows, that type of thing. You can see on the bottom of the graph there are the different cost bins. So for the annual, we are showing the major availability over the next 20 years is the annual that is under $45 a megawatt hour, or the $45 to $55 a megawatt hour is the big chunk there. If you look at the winter, the most we have is in that high bin, which is over $120 a megawatt hour. We do have a significant chunk in the under 45. Our solar potential. So again, I mentioned this was driven from our feedback from talking to customers during the workshop. We looked at 2 different levels of incentives, potential incentives, and looked across our residential customers, our small CNI customers, and our medium CNI customers. And the dark colors in all 3 of these graphs is the baseline. That means we're not doing anything that's available potential that we have for rooftop solar. And then tier 1 and then tier 2 is stacked on top of those. So as you can see, the residential has the greatest amount of potential. We also looked at costs. So this is societal cost by sector and incentives. And again, we have residential, small, and medium load. Even though the residential shows the most potential, it's also the most cost, the highest cost on here. So if we have tier 1 or tier 2, we're pushing up in that $120 megawatt hour cost. Small load is a little better, still right around $100, and medium load shows the best at under $60 a megawatt hour.
And what does SPA stand for?
Solar potential assessment, sorry. And then how do we find shared energy management or demand response opportunities? So we break it out by sector across the top there, commercial, industrial, potential, or residential. And then we have our products that we have on the left-hand side. So direct load control are things like smart thermostats that either the customer can control or we could control. Also water heater controls, we could do that. Demand curtailment is only under industrial because that usually involves contracts with large customers in order to have them shift, possibly different shifts that are being worked at, working processes, moving those around. So those are usually under contracts. And then we have our time varying prices, so the different rates options. And I know the rates folks have been here to talk about the time of use rates and critical peak pricing. Now, first we'll come up and talk about peak management.
All right. I had to shift in a little bit, but demand response is a portion of this, but peak management, right? Talking about how we're billed from Bonneville. So storage resources under this model can provide a lot of value to the PUD by reducing our peak demand requirements. And we are billed based on our peak demand requirements from Bonneville. The new to us now is a Washington state law, and energy storage, battery energy storage, provides REC equivalence for regulatory compliance. And we are expecting to access a new capacity credit in the post-Bonneville, post-2028 contract. The first year that we're giving batteries availability based on feasibility and build times is about 2029. We expect the battery cost to be about $9 a kilowatt month.
So storage here is defined as only batteries, not the
recipes. We have both. They do carry slightly different characteristics though. And then what it's being compared against is the Bonneville demand charge. And we're expecting those to be about $10.62 a kilowatt month. So there's value to be had. Levelized cost of capacity. So this is going to take into account some of those benefits. The capacity credit from Bonneville, it does include IRA credits or the Inflation Reduction Act credits. On the far left, you can see the 25 megawatt 4-hour battery, very similar to what we're building in Arlington right now. In the yellow is Bonneville's demand charge, and that's on average. It does vary by month. In the brown, I guess, or black, that's a reference plant for a simple cycle combustion turbine gas plant.
That came in that high.
The simple cycle. They we do include the societal cost of carbon in there and fuel prices. So those do carry some additional costs that you would not otherwise see in a battery. That is for CETA reference only. It's not part of our potential resource mix, but we do have to have a CETA reference baseline. A new technology that's come onto the market that you might hear about is 100-hour iron air batteries. So there's a company out in West Virginia that's building those. We did throw those in there for comparison. And then on the far right is biodiesel. So using plant matter or whatever to create diesel and then running it through a diesel turbine generator. That has a significant cost because of that fuel. And I put all these on a 2026 delivery. Not all of them would be available in 2026, but I wanted to compare them on apples to apples. So same year. So that was storage and batteries. So that helps us with our peak demand. But when we're talking about the other portion of it, that's our energy demand, our annual energy. So let's talk about the supply side resources, resource menu that we've agreed upon with the tech team. So as we move into load following, it changes how we think about resources. Different attributes are critical to us now. Bonneville does require resource support services or RSS for some types of resources if we're going to bring them to load. So, and what those do is they flatten and deliver an annual block of energy from a variable resource. And that carries a cost to those kinds of resources. Those costs depend on the variance between what you said you were going to do, your planned amounts, versus what you actually do. So it's a little bit unknown. Right now, it's sort of you get that bill at the end of the year. The other part of it is network transmission. We're changing our transmission product. Our old point-to-point contracts would have allowed us to bring energy directly home on those point-to-point contracts, which we bake into the cost of those resources. NT changes that, and we don't necessarily get billed on how a resource gets delivered to us. So, it also means that we can get some savings if there's a resource within the county here that can generate energy. We went through an exercise with our tech team. We have something 56 or 60 members of a tech team of PUD staff. We went through this. Commissioner Logan, I know you mentioned during our phase two research that geothermal was something you were interested in looking at. The tech team also agreed. They said geothermal should be on the menu, so it does show up here. These resource costs do include fuel, if applicable, RSS, and VERBS. VERBS are a balancing service we pay to Bonneville because we're part of their balancing authority, meaning that they hold reserves for frequency response. So if it requires VERBS, it's included here. On the left, you have your baseload resources, or what we're calling baseload. So geothermal, Bonneville Tier 2 is always delivered in annual blocks. Solar and wind plus storage, that acts more like a baseload resource than a variable resource. We are giving some consideration to small modular reactors and fusion. Those were both in our 2023 IRP. We're putting them a little further out into the study period so that we are allowing that technology time to mature. And then finally at the bottom there is in red, our CETA baseline reference for a combined cycle gas plant. So that's in there for reference as well. In the middle, you have variable resources. These are gonna be on average cheaper. There's less equipment for your solar and wind projects than there would be for a solar plus battery, but they are more variable. We are going to look at a new Runner River hydro plant here within the county. So another Young's Creek, for example. There's also some regional projects that we looked at last time as a potential buyout option for Runner River. We're looking at a couple different flavors of utility scale solar, small utility scale solar here in the county. So 1 to 5 megawatts. We'll look at some regional utility scale solar, Gorge and Montana wind. And then, like Michael said, that customer rooftop incentive. And then on the right, those are those peakers or dispatchable resources that we talked about before. I'm only looking at energy resources here, so I didn't include any of the peaker or the storage resources on this graph, but these are the levelized cost of energy. If they were delivered in 2026, none of these are available for delivery in 2026. We're assuming that they have some, you know, delay for delivery. We got to build them. But this kind of gives you an illustration of what costs we're looking at. And these are the all-in costs. So they include RSS, the transmission credits if available, VERBs if required, all of those requirements, and those IRA credits. On the left, you have your baseload resources. And then on the right, you have your variable resources. So as you can see, the variables tend to be slightly cheaper, but they're also going to have less deliverability. A question, Commissioner Olson? Okay. So that's the resource menu as proposed. The other part of this that we're going to be looking at is BPA Tier 2. We've kind of beat around the bush for BPA Tier 2 for a long time. Now we need to actually talk about what that is and how it's going to impact our resource options. Tier 2 comes in two flavors or two types, short-term Tier 2 and long-term Tier 2. Short-term Tier 2 is on a rate period by rate period basis, and it's market-based. So it'll be essentially a market product. We are adding in some factors in there, but it's a market-based product. That can be displaced with a new non-federal resource. So if you're taking 50 megawatts of short-term Tier 2 and you buy 50 megawatts of a solar plant, you can reduce your Tier 2 take on the short-term side. Probably doesn't come with any RECs. It's market-based, so there's not going to be any environmental attributes there. On the other hand, long-term Tier 2, we looked at Bonneville's resource program, which is their equivalent IRP, to see what that's going to look like. We did find that it's roughly 50-50 solar to market at the end of the study period, but it starts as all market. So it's going to look like short-term for the near term in the near term of our study period and diverge over time. So we'll give it some RECs based on its composition, right? How much solar is in it, and then it can't be displaced. So if you take 5 megawatts of long-term Tier 2, you get 5 megawatts of long-term Tier 2 until the next Bonneville contract. Quick note, all Tier 2 products do get delivered in that flat block. So they kind of go at the bottom. Tier 1 is the thing that flexes up and down with our load. And then Tier 2 is only for above high watermark load. So that's going to mean that we really only take what we need. If we have 7 megawatts, we get 7 megawatts, even if our election is for 100.
Yeah, utility purchase both short-term and long-term.
Yep. Thank you for team. Yeah. So we have a choice. What version of Tier 2 do we want first? We can either take a fixed amount of long-term Tier 2 first or a fixed amount of short-term first. If we take long-term first, the remainder of our above high watermark load is served with either short-term or non-federal resources. On the other hand, if you take a fixed amount of short-term or non-federals first, long-term sort of fills in the gap afterwards. There's some nuances to this. One, we have to make an election for how much of whatever we want here in early 2026 with Bonneville. If we choose the long-term first and we have a fixed amount of long-term Tier 2, we do have a one-time option to reduce that amount to whatever we want minus whatever we already take. And then we do expect to have above high watermark load in the first year of that 2028 contract. So this election is basically for that amount of load.
have a question on timing. Because I thought that some of these other considerations, sources, you said that many of them will not be ready for a number of years.
Yep.
So then does that drive you towards taking Tier 2?
It can. It's going to depend on what sort of what the optimization says is the best choice for us. We're giving a start date of 2029, which 2028, 2029 for some of the regional renewable projects, which is pretty in line with what we're seeing in the market, right? Customer, or we've gone out and requested data on some of the projects that are being developed. They all said they were going to be available in 2028 or 2029, which is about when we were going to need Tier 2 anyway. So,
oh.
Yeah. But yes, it's a good question. We have to make a choice of what kind of Tier 2 service we want and if we can displace it. That is a core question of the IRP. Probably useful to look at the costs. On the left, I put 2026 delivery for comparison, 2031 and 2041. I also put it against the least cost, renewable resources just for comparison. The dark green is long-term Tier 2 and the light green is short-term Tier 2. As you can see in 2026, they are the same because we're expecting long-term Tier 2 to essentially be market-based. And that diverges over time as more and more solar gets pushed into that long-term Tier 2 composition. So long-term gets more expensive over time than short-term based on that.
You said that long-term we get it, or Tier 2 we get as a block.
Yeah, it gets delivered as block.
So doesn't that make it more of a baseload resource? It's either you're comparing these to variable resources.
Variable resources get flattened and delivered as blocks based on that RSS cost. Okay. So it's really a delivery question and where that goes on the stack.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So our resource menu? Sure.
So one of the things I've been thinking about as we go through this, so all of these things have a risk, right? These are our estimates based on what we see now, the cost to build things, projecting Bonneville's tier. How do we assess the risk of, say, like buying Tier 2 from Bonneville, and there's some uncertainty about what rates will do? It's not like they may have to procure, they may have to go out and build things like these.
Absolutely.
Versus the cost of building, and there's always uncertainty, especially with newer technologies, about what the actual cost will be. Do we weight these things with different risk?
So what we're doing is we have several scenarios and sensitivities where resource costs are being reflective of different conditions that the world could be in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Same thing with Bonneville, right? We're giving Bonneville, we have different market price forecasts, so we know, you know, if the market prices are lower, Bonneville Tier 2 will be less expensive. So within those scenarios and sensitivities, we have a lot of range, and that gives us a lot of information about kind of the world that could be if resource costs are higher than we expect.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Yes, thank you. So do you think that when the price is not going to be impact, I mean, in the future, I mean, Bonneville and everything regarding what happened in federal?
Yeah. So I think the question you're asking is what happens if federal policy changes? Yes. So we are looking at the world right now as it is, right? We've included those federal policies as they stand today. If that changes in the future, we do have sensitivities around price variations, whether that's on the Bonneville side or on the resource side. So we do capture that risk variable within those sensitivities and scenarios. So I think we have a good understanding of sort of our ranges, and then we'll know once we put those variables into the optimization engine, what the sort of outcomes would be, what that changes for us.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions on this one? All right. In summary, Our resource menu is looking for load growth. We're going to look at demand side resources, supply side resources, and BPA tier two. We are going to define a tier two strategy for our 26 election. And that's got to be the pathway and the fixed amount of our first option. And then the load following product really has significantly changed how we think about resources and how we think about what they do in an IRP sense. So those are kind of the high level takeaways. We are expecting to come back around the end of the summer, talk about the optimization and what the results are showing. So that's kind of our next steps. But I do want to give as much time as we have for questions. You can go back to any slide.
I don't have it. I don't have any questions, but we need to remember that this started out with they're looking for, as they move along this path, if we have anything that I should have talked for you, should I? But when I see that they're looking for input from us that I would assume would drive next steps, do we have any further input? Because based upon our questions and today, is that enough for you, assurance?
Well, you are the experts here. Saying that you refer the time to choice. So what would you recommend? Which is the best?
We don't know what that answer is quite yet. It's going to depend a lot on the study results. That's part of the core question of this IRP is how do we meet our regulatory compliance needs? How do we, what's our BPA tier two preference between non-feds, long-term, short-term? And how do we do that with the least cost, least risk pathway? So that this is the setup and the menu that the plan can pick from, but we don't have the results quite yet. That's phase four. That's the next steps. So.
Yeah, thank you for the question. It's a good question because I think you started out saying feedback about, so I guess I'm not seeing where I'm interested in putting my hand on the scale for one resource.
But the menu.
Yeah. It's interesting.
It's a lot of fun for me because I get to go play in a little bit of like fanciful, you know, what could happen in 2040. So that's really fun for me. But
I just wanted to make sure you got that.
Yep. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great job, Chris. So that wraps up the presentations.
Okay, next is item four, our CEO General Manager report for today.
Yeah, a couple items to share. HR wanted to announce that June 10th blood drive results. We had 25 donors, 24 units of blood were collected, including four first-time donors. Also, corporate communication, our staff met with the Delta Neighborhood Association to continue the discussion on the future transmission line. The attendees expressed appreciation that the PUD had been responsive to their earlier concerns about the project. The project team will meet with the city next to discuss the beautification of the poles, and we'll continue further outreach with the neighborhood associations and constituents in that area. Also, out of our customer energy services, and this is really positive news, customer energy services just launched our post-call surveys on May 15th, where our customers now can give us direct feedback on their call service experiences. In our first month of surveys, we have received an impressive 1,180 surveys, with 883 customers leaving us a perfect 10 and an average customer satisfaction score of 9.28 out of a 10. So that is really cool. And again, another exciting thing that our customer energy services group is doing. Happy to answer any questions or take any comments.
Any questions for Joe?
Yes.
Next, we have item five, public hearing in action. 5A, disposal of surplus property for order 2025. I'll call for a motion. Based on staff recommendations that the items are no longer necessary or useful to the district, I move that those items listed on exhibits A and B of the surplus property recommendation report be declared surplus and be sold for high bid or disposed of according to policy in the third quarter of 2025. We'll now convene a public hearing. Lines are available to answer any questions. So first I'll ask if there's any questions from the public. Please raise your hand. I'm not seeing any hands online or in the room. Commissioners, do you have any questions?
I have no question.
Okay, hearing none. I will close the public hearing. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Next, agenda item six, items for individual consideration. 6A, consideration of a resolution authorizing the CEO General Manager or his designee on behalf of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County to execute an agreement assigning the district's PNWAC transmission service rights under the Pacific Northwest AC Infinite Capacity Ownership Agreement, the Citadel Energy Marketing LLC. I'll call for a motion. We have Garrison Mark available to answer any questions about this. Are there any comments from the public regarding the resolution? Please raise your hand. Hands up online or in the room. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
I have none. No, we've had extensive briefings on
have. Great. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passed unanimously. Next is 6B, consideration of a resolution authorizing the CEO General Manager or its designee on behalf of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County to execute a WSPP agreement Schedule B confirmation with Morgan Stanley Capital Group Incorporated for the district's output share of the Hate Canyon Wind Project. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Mr. Marr is also available to answer any questions regarding this. Are there any comments from the public regarding the resolution? Please raise your hands. No hands raised online or in the room. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
I have none.
I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Next is 6C, consideration of a resolution authorizing the CEO General Manager or his designee on behalf of Public Utility District Number 1 of Snohomish County to execute a WSPP Agreement Schedule B confirmation and a WSPP Schedule R confirmation with Public Utility District Number 1 of Franklin County for the district's output share of the Wheatfield Wind Power Project. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Okay, Mr. Barr is also available to answer any questions about this. Are there any questions or comments from the public regarding this item? Seeing no hands up. Are there any questions or comments from you, Commissioner?
I have none.
Okay. Call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion passed unanimously. Next, agenda item 7, Commission Business, 7A Commission Report. Are there reports, Commissioner?
I have none.
You can
have it.
Commissioner Alperon Crosby and I just returned from the American Public Power Association, and I have to say I was very proud to watch John Harlow be installed as the new chair of the American Public Power Association. Quite an accomplishment. I also enjoyed very much when Jerry Rice, famous wide receiver, gave John some fashion advice and some dance instruction. But those are your memories forever. Are we going to cue the video now?
Wanted to demonstrate?
did not let you see that again.
No, thank you.
Anyway, it was a good conference. One of the things I went to was a session on how to approach interactions with the public in positive ways. And one takeaway for me, this is one very simple thing. Instead of asking a customer what we did wrong, fill out a complaint form. Ask a customer how we can do better. So anyway. Any other reports?
I want to say congratulations. You know, that was very nice, and I really still process a lot all the conference and classes they took and Sunday, and that were very helpful, and also to the networking with different people that attend. That was eye-opening for me, find different women, Latinas too, I mean, involved in energy, that blew my mind. So that's really, it was pretty nice. So thank you.
Next is 7B, our Commissioner Events Calendar. Are there any changes to the events calendar?
I have
not hearing any. Okay. Next, we move on to 8A, our governance planning calendar. Changes to governance planning calendar. This is on page 140 of the packet. Little note, I think we have a, connect up update coming. Some of the conversations we had today, we can have again.
July 1st,
yeah.
And again, I want to commend the commission clerks for, this is really fleshed out much better than it was.
Yep.
And I do appreciate that.
Okay.
I'm sorry. For the commissioner event calendar, will you leave us?
Yes, we did. But do you want to go back to it?
Yes, for July 16, for Economic Alliance, Snohomish County, it is okay if I attend as well, or is only the two commissioners?
No, I'm sure.
Oh, no. Okay.
You probably have an invite somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Reach out to.
Thank you so much for appreciating.
Is there any further business coming before the board? Hearing none, it is 11:26 and our meeting is adjourned.